You're listening to Celtic Music Lab on the lineupmedia.fm podcast network, where we explore the world of Celtic music, new and old. And now, here's your host, Tommy Martin.
Hello and good morning, good afternoon, good evening from wherever and whenever you're listening. This is Tommy Martin.
And I'm John Baldwin.
And we're at the Celtic Music Lab, where we were just talking about Irish music. And from time to time, we listen to a few clips and we tell stories of our travels and adventures and discuss the important aspects of the music from the Celtic nations. So we'll be discussing Irish music, Scottish music, some Breton from France and Galician from Spain and maybe Cornish and Manx and all that fun stuff. Now, John, you've been on your travels.
Indeed, I have. I was at the Dublin, Ohio Irish Festival but a couple of weeks ago. It was actually a really nice time. It was a lot bigger than I expected because I'd never gone before. You know, I've been living out of the country for years. But one of the things that I was most impressed with was just the level of organization. There was a huge festival. There were tons of shows, tons of bands, a lot of different food items, different artisan crafts, and also a high number of people driving golf carts around.
Oh, yeah.
I even got a ride myself. It was actually really nice. It was back to my car to drop stuff off, but it was kind of an adventure through like the woods, you know.
Yeah.
In and around the festival. Have you ever been yourself?
I have. I was there a couple of years ago. I played with a band with Mick Broderick and Matt Mancuso and Danny from Donegal. Danny, what's your second name? Can't think of Danny's second name. But it was fantastically organized. We had a kind of a pass with a barcode on it. And you would swipe that when you're going into the green room for your food and for if you needed to leave an instrument at a place to go off and do something else. You swipe this and this had your information, your details, and you swipe that everywhere you went, and it was perfectly well organized.
Yeah, right indeed. Well, even though I was pretty much a nobody showing up, I did mention that I was with this Celtic Music Lab podcast.
Oh, good man.
And I ended up getting a media pass, so...
Oh, very good.
Yeah, like, they even had stuff for latecomers, I suppose, so...
Right, very good.
Yeah, it was lovely. And, oh, man, it was... I just met so many good people, and it's so nice to me that the bands are really accessible, you know? Like, the people are really open to talk to. I got to meet the folks from Drowsy Lads. Martine was there as well.
Oh, Martine de Cogan. Very good.
I talked a little bit with Wee Banjo 3 and also Solas. And also Gwicha, which is a wonderful band. And we're going to have interviews from a lot of those people that I've just mentioned so far within the next couple of weeks. So today, later in the show, we'll have Martine de Cogan.
Oh, very good.
And it was a really lovely time. I can't say that I slept much the entire weekend, but I did get home alive, so that's...
Oh, well, that's good. Well, it's a sign of a good festival.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, I should mention it was Danny Burns was the fourth member of that band. Sorry, Danny, if you're listening. So we had a good old time. Yeah, it's a good festival, and it's nicely laid out. You got the different. Is it like six stages?
Oh, absolutely! I had no less than five fairly large stages.
Oh yeah,
for
they're
music.
Good sized stages.
Yeah.
And then you have the kind of the Celtic rock band
exactly.
Way off down the other end of the festival ground, so they can be as loud as they want, and they don't interfere with the other kind of quieter stages, which is a great idea, and everybody is accommodated.
I tell you what, one of the things that surprised me most about the Dublin, Ohio Festival was the large amount of youth and the inclusiveness of the surrounding community, or at least so it seemed. I mean, this is a festival that we're talking about, and I'm just guessing here. I didn't actually get numbers, but I'm assuming some 20,000 people a day come in and out.
At least, yeah.
At least, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So we were talking a little bit about the FLA. What were you saying about that?
Yes, I have word from Ireland. So this weekend, so we're here we are now. We're getting to the end of August, and just a weekend. Today's the 22nd, as the day we're recording. So just to put so you'll know we're not going crazy. So the couple of days before was the weekend of the All Ireland FLA Kill na Héireann. In Ireland, which is an Irish music competition weekend. And it's really a week-long event. You have a week, from Monday to Friday, you have a week of workshops and classes for all the different instruments featured in the competitions. So you have classes for your uilleann pipes and flutes and whistles, accordions, harps, etc., etc. And some singing classes as well. And I believe there isn't Irish dancing classes. There might be a set dancing workshop. They don't accommodate solo dancing, I know. And I think there might be Irish language or debating kind of workshops. Anyway, and being that we're broadcasting from St. Louis, we have to give a big congratulations to St. Louis Irish Arts, who came third place in the over 18 group of Keol or ensemble group music competition, which is a fantastic achievement. I think there was 19 in the groups in the competition. And so well done, everybody. And well done for all your hard work. It's a fun weekend. I used to compete in those things years ago when I was a kid, and I'd go to the Skull Extra, and you make friends for life, and you have a wonderful time playing music. And it's a good encouragement to practice for the competitions. But there is, now we won't go into it all right now today, but there is a huge debate on the merits and value of competitions within folk music genres. People say, there shouldn't be competitions in Irish music, or there should be no competitions at a FLA. Well, a FLA is a competition. It's kind of like saying that there shouldn't be competitions at the Olympics, which is a bit redundant. But the problem is with folk music genres in general is if you're going to have a competition, you have to have rules, because you have to be able to distinguish between the placing orders. You need rules and some kind of point system to separate first, second, third, etc. So you need some kind of judging structure. But when you do that, when you apply a judging structure over people's individual personal styles and styles developed within a folk genre, and especially within a genre where you have lots of regional styles, it's difficult to kind of categorize everybody into one box so you can take them out in an order of competitive kind of wordiness.
Right.
But then on the other side of the coin, it's a great excuse to get kids to practice, because I know when we were kids, if we weren't good enough to qualify for the All-Ireland Flag Hill, we didn't get to have a summer vacation. Oh, we might go somewhere, but that was a trip to see your friends that you met last year.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So that was, if you don't qualify, you don't go.
Well, to see your friends at the FLA, you mean?
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So you don't get, that was your summer trip. And if you didn't get to qualify, you didn't go. But that was kind of parental kind of encouragement from our folks to get your finger out and do a bit of work. We paid money for these damn instruments, but you go off and learn how to play them, please. But that's something that's going to, I know it's going to come up again soon, because as we talk to some, we're going to be conducting interviews here later on with some people who teach students who compete at FLAs, and then we'll talk to some of the competitors as well, and people who have competed throughout their lives. So it's an hour, and maybe if you want to, if people at home, there's a Facebook page people can offer their thoughts on.
The Celtic Music Lab. Yes, we are on Facebook at Celtic Music Lab. We are also on Twitter and Instagram.
Oh, well, there you go.
You can find us just about anywhere at Celtic Music Lab.
So if you have any thoughts on competitions and their value or lack of value, feel free to chime in. Sure, we can read out your comments from time to time as well. I'd be happy to do that.
Absolutely. We love comments.
Yeah. On the clean ones, you know.
Or not.
Or not, yeah.
So I saw a discussion on the session today that was kind of interesting, and something that even while I was at the Dublin, Ohio Irish Festival that, kind of came up a couple times in conversation, and it was the use of stomp boxes. Now, stomp boxes, for anybody who doesn't know out there, are basically these little boxes or MIDI activators that control what would be like a kick drum sound. And so there's a steady boom, 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 boom. And a lot of bands have started using these for their live shows, especially at festivals. And now this is somewhat of a faux pas for a lot of fans of folk music. They think it's not necessary. I see it as maybe something that actually works and is kind of just a product of the times. But that's really an opinion. Please feel free to comment on that as well. But I mean, Tommy, what's your take on the use of stomp boxes in particular?
It's the work of the devil. Now you mentioned the Dublin Ohio Festival. When I was there 2 years ago, there was, I counted. And we commented. It was a bit of a comment that night. after all the performances, you know, the kind of hotel bar where the performers were staying, I think we counted 7 or 8 bands that were using stomp boxes. And it looks like it's basically a 2x4 with a cable.
So yeah,
a power cable, an electrical cord going into one end, and a microphone cable coming out the other end that you plug in. So you just bang your foot in it and it makes a big noise. It's kind of, I found them kind of redundant at festivals, especially for the bigger bands. Smaller bands, okay, if you want to get a bigger sound and you encourage people to kind of jump around and have a bit of extra fun, that's fine. But for the bigger bands, it's a kind of a cheap drum kit.
Well, here's the thing that I think, and it is kind of like a little cheap drum kit, but it's a cheap little trick that works. And I think of the lowest common denominator. Now, when you're at these festivals, you have a lot of people that are diehard fans of the genre.
Yeah.
And a lot of people that just are there for the crack.
Yeah.
You know, like people that are there just to have a good time. And for the people that are there just to have a good time, at least it helps them know when to clap.
Yeah, it does.
Myself included, like, sometimes they can drive me a little nuts, you know, because, like, if you use it every once in a while, that's fine, but, like, give at least a tune or two of breathing space and don't use it in every song. That's
exactly.
That's all I'd say.
And use it kind of liberally for what it is, a novelty.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
yeah.
It's the djembe of the 90s. Remember the 1990s? Those bands with djembes, and all they're good for is putting flowers in. You'd go to a session, there'd be lads banging these things between their legs. They were god awful racket out of them. And it's not that they're not a bad instrument.
In the right hands, I think.
I saw a Kenyan performance group, a djembe performance group at a festival in New York years ago, and I thought it was a stunning thing. These guys were acrobats and fantastic percussionists. They were really getting very varied, different sound, various different sounds from the instrument, and playing really well. And then you go to a fla or a festival and you see some lad there and he's lugging around this thing because you know they're only carrying it to put extra cheap beer into, so you can smuggle beer onto the festival grounds, and then you can bang the thing and it's just a one monotonous tone. You hear, you know, in the middle of nice reels and jigs, like da 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 da. Oh, it's like a wardrobe falling down the stairs.
Yeah, I went to a bluegrass session one time and somebody had brought a darbuka.
Oh, those yokes. The ones darbuka. Where you put your hand into the back of it.
And they had no clue what they were doing. I mean, like, I think second to that, and it wasn't nearly as bad because the guy was a little bit more of a musician, but at another session one time, there was a trombone player.
What?
Right next to me, yeah.
Trombone,
yeah.
Just so, playing bass lines.
Well, no, really. Sometimes
playing melody,
trying to play the tunes.
Oh, good man.
Well, yeah, good man. Except for there's a lot of glissando, so a lot of new, like, you know.
Genie Mac. Well, fair play. Yeah, well, variety is the spice of life. I remember years ago, does it? And people who let this be a lesson to all of you who see people playing instruments in front of you at a session in a pub or at a festival or wherever, or you see somebody on TV playing, you'll think to yourself, sure, that's not that difficult at all. You know, if chap came into a session I was playing at one time and he asked the bartender for 2 spoons because he had seen somebody else recently playing spoons.
No.
Get that clickety clackety sound.
Right.
And he thought, oh, sure, this is fantastic. There's a bit of music. I've got spoons. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, just put them in your soup. Keep them there.
You'd be only wishing for Uri Geller to walk in. But I said to the chap, well, look, if you're only a beginner, we all started with beginner style instruments. You know, with the pipes, I started with a practice set. You know, Michelle here started with a 3/4 size fiddle. Well, I should only recommend that if you're going to start playing the spoons, start with one. And as you get good at that, you can progress to 2. And he talked to work your way
up to maybe a spork.
yeah.
Plastic spoons.
Or Stanley knife.
Practice.
So this chap put one spoon into his top pocket and proceeded to play with one spoon between his hand and his knee, which is great.
Yeah.
He was having a great old time and we couldn't hear a thing.
We were playing tunes one time with another friend of mine that played in a band that I was in. And he's a great percussionist. The thing was, though, he was maybe he had a couple to drink, and he played so loud, and he really tore up the table that he was playing on too. And like one of the guys that we were playing tunes with was the bar owner. He's watching his table just get destroyed. Like every time this guy like would hit it off the table, he'd leave like a bunch of dents in it.
Oh, gee.
You know, I'm losing hearing over here, and I just kept going. So we eventually made a couple comments to the volume of the spoons,
and yeah.
I think he got a little burnt, but at least he stopped.
Yeah. And that's the thing that we will, I know will come up here on the Celtic Music Lab. Because there's the thing that's going to come up on the Celtic Music Lab from time to time is session etiquette.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. There's a chap up in Barry Foy. He's up in St. Paul, either St. Paul or Minneapolis, and one of the Twin Cities. He lives up there and he's a fine fiddle player. He's a great fiddle player. And he wrote a book a few years back. Now, we'll have to call him and get him to talk to us sometime on our podcast. Barry Foy, yeah, he wrote a book, and it's kind of basically on session etiquette, how to behave. Huh. And it's a couple of very general rules. Now, I don't want to quote him because I don't have the book in front of me, but he mentions basically just kind of mannerly behavior and what to expect and what not to expect and how welcoming you should feel you should be, you know, presenting yourself to strangers to play music. But there's a couple of general rules. I mean, if you can hear yourself really well, you're too loud.
Yeah, I'll agree.
You know, if so, you need to.
Or you're playing a whistle.
Or you're playing a. Oh, God, yeah. Brain damage. But you could be just lucky. I mean, but if you're sitting in a big session with a lot of musicians, and when I say a lot, I mean more than five or six, like when it's getting right. Busy, if you hear yourself, you're too loud. And that goes for all kinds of things. If it's fiddle or guitar or pipes or, you know, you need to either review your situation, make an adjustment and continue on and not be the star of the show.
Hmm. Well, I think, folks, we're going to take a minute here to play the recorded interview from the Dublin, Ohio Irish Festival with Martin de Cogan. I hope you enjoy it. I know that I did. He's such a good storyteller and really a nice guy.
Hey, this is Tig from the band Gucci, and you're listening to the Celtic Music Lab.
All right, this is John Baldwin. We're at the Dublin, Ohio Irish Festival. I'm joined here right now by Martin de Cogan.
Hello. Hello, everybody out there listening, wherever you are, sitting down on a nice couch or driving around in your car or sleeping in your bed. I'm Martin de Cogan, and I'm delighted to be here with John at the Dublin Irish Festival. It's 2016, I think, still. And we're all thoroughly exhausted from 3 days of onslaught of music. But I'm very happy to be talking about myself now to John.
Martin, I understand that your birthday was yesterday.
That's right.
Happy birthday to you.
Thanks very much. Another year around the sun. Another year around the sun. Fair play to me, as John Splann would say. And we had a beautiful donut cake with 4 candles, although it meant no because it's not, my birthday doesn't divide by 4. So it was nonsensical.
Yeah.
Totally nonsensical.
So Martin, for anybody out there who does not know who you are, could you explain a little bit to us about who you are, what you do, and why you're at this festival even?
Well, I grew up in a small town south of Cork City called Carrigaline. There used to be a famous pottery there one time, John. Carrigaline Pottery. There's great clay in Carrigaline. But alas, the pottery and myself have since left. I grew up in a house with 9 other siblings, and my parents have instilled in me great graw and a draw for Irish music. And so there was always Irish music in my house, and my mother did great things to try and make me into a musician. She brought me to fiddle classes for 6 months, bagpipe classes for 6 months, accordion classes for 2 years, piano classes for 2 years, whistle lessons for 7 years, and then I ended up being a Bowron player in the finish. So she didn't succeed. But with that, she sent me to singing lessons. My dad and herself sent me to singing lessons to Danny Mikey O'Sullivan. He's a fella from the country in West Cork in Coolay. And he lives in Mahon. He's a great singer, comes from a great lineage of the O'Sullivans, the Mikey O'Sullivans. And his brother, Dermadine Mikey, was a very famous singer. He was on Ornigy as a radio host, I think it was. And himself and his brother, Oni, do a lot still. Oni Mikey and Danny Mikey. But I went down to Danny Mikey when I was about 15, and I started to learn songs. And around this time, John, I used to be going to the Flas, which are these big celebrations of Irish music among kind of Irish music nerds before it got cool, before Michael Flatley brought it to the world. We were there alone in a small campsite, you know, with terrible showers, but we loved it. And I didn't, like, my sisters played and things like that. And I used to go to the Flaz, and I remember being there at 13 or 14, seeing the circle of musicians and this magic, and wondering, how do I get in within that circle? How do I join the magic? And then I learned a few songs, and a few songs kind of got me closer to it. And it wasn't until I went to college then that I started learning the Bord On. I turned up, my parents run a Coltis branch, which is Coltis Culture in here, and it's a kind of in the 50s they started this, not them, but a fellow, Lauroso Marcou, and a few more, started this kind of push to revive Irish music, song, dance, language, with Coltis. And this branch is now Cravena throughout the world, a lot of them here in America as well, and they teach inexpensive lessons and try and help students with finding, you know, instruments that wouldn't be too taxing on a family that mightn't be able to afford it and things like that. And so I went in on my way home from college looking for a lift home on a Wednesday night, and they said, why don't you just jump into the Bord On class there? And I said, ah. And I had this small diminutive, probably a 5-inch Bord On with a hole in it, and I didn't know that I'd even have a stick. And I went into the class, and Eric Cunningham was teaching, and I said, oh well, it's not that bad, like. And I went back the next time, and I got a bigger one which wasn't tunable, and it was terrible sounding, and it was a terrible stick. And I kept going for about 3 months, and then I had exams or something like that, and I came back the following year in the January, that was October, came back in January, and Eric had moved on, and I ended up being the teacher. The Bord On's not that hard. And so anyway,
you became the teacher after how long?
3 months. And so the class were like, weren't you learning last term? But anyway, I kind of, things kind of rolled then.
Fair question.
Things kind of started to snowball then, you know. I was kind of finishing up in college, and like, we used to have massive raucous sing songs, like, you know, and I was doing acting as well, so the stage was calling. And I decided, like a lot of Irish people, that I'd go off around the world. Which I'm taking on the story. I hope you're still travelling with us at this point. But in Ireland, we have free education, and you come out with no debt and no worries and no need to get a job straight away. So you just say, I'll find myself. And as the fella says, John, no matter where you go, there you are. And I went off around the world, and I was staying with a friend of mine in Wellington, New Zealand, after getting a lift down from Auckland. And
was that the first place you went?
No, I went to America first.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I went to San Francisco first, and we had a load of sing songs there. And
why did you choose America first?
Well, I went west, and there was friends of mine who put me up. I didn't have a lot of money, obviously, because
right.
I didn't have any interest in work. And I had a 7-stop ticket that you could keep changing all the time. And I stopped in San Francisco, and he told me to go to, if any of you know San Francisco, it's pretty big. He said, go to Post and Lark, and I showed up. That was the directions I had in an email. No number or anything. So I went to Post and Larkin, which is in the Tenderloin, like. I mean, you wouldn't go there during the day, like. And I shouted up, Kieran! And I was there for about 10 minutes. And I finally got, like, his Irish mobile and phoned him, and he came down. And as it turns out, I stayed in that apartment for, like, 2 weeks, and there wasn't a lock on the door. It was hilarious, like. And they didn't even have a bed. Anyway, I'll move on, I'll give it. They were there for a year, and they had no bed in this apartment, like, in the Tenderloin. It was like the slums of London in the 80s, like. But anyway,
I feel like you got to relive a bit of history there.
Yeah, it was nice sleeping on the ground in a sleeping bag that I brought, like, you know, for camping. And
oh, that's luxurious.
It was luxurious, yeah. And my girlfriend, my wife, she was my girlfriend at that time, was in LA, and so she had come back from Ireland, and I went down to meet her, but she went off to Alaska for a while, and I watched the house and watched the World Cup and put on about a stone and weighed with M&Ms and chicken wings.
For the audience, could you explain to our listeners what a stone is?
A stone is 14 pounds, which is quite a lot. Anyway, and then we went on a road trip across America out to Topeka, Route 66 and back through Colorado and Vegas. And then I went down to Peru and to Ecuador, And then 3 weeks working in a hostel in Hawaii.
Was this still part of your 7-stop ticket?
This was stop number 2 was Hawaii. I did sojourns to South America.
That sounds like the Charlie's Golden Ticket.
It was pretty cool. I'm quite amazing. But we're very lucky that we don't have like massive debt in Ireland. You know what I mean?
Right.
After college, that you can be this kind of free. My budget for the year was 3.5 grand, and so that's why I slept on a floor with a sleeping bag. Like, and so I went to 3 weeks working in a hostel, in the Polynesian hostel in Hawaii, and a night in Fiji, and then I arrived in New Zealand. My first day in New Zealand, I got picked up by a friend of my brother's who was going to leave me sleep on her floor in a sleeping bag. And
with her, did you at least have a contact, or did you have another intersection?
No, she picked me up at the airport, which was amazing. Bevan, if she's listening out there in New Zealand, and she brought me to the Irish import shop. You know, you'd be tired and be like, oh, this is the last place I want to go. She said, oh, they've Bowron. So she said, do you play the Bowron? I said, yeah, I play the Bowron. I'd been playing for like maybe 2 years at this point. I said, oh yeah, God, you're very good. There's a show here in town in like the biggest theatre in the country, the Theatre Centre, and they're looking for a Bowron player. And I said, I was 5 hours on the country and I had a gig. It's hilarious, like. It's hilarious. I couldn't get a gig at home, same like.
Well, after all, you did have 3 months of lessons.
I did. Well, yes, absolutely.
And how many years of teaching after that?
Well, that was probably 3 months of teaching. So anyway, I went from there down to Wellington and I played a football match against the manager of a bar, Molly Malone's, and I had sung the night before at some Irish function, like, or whatever, like this, they had a small little fish or a fla. And this old lady went up to him. I think his name was Michael. And I said, you should book this fella for your bar. So he said, okay, yeah, what are you doing Friday night? I said, I don't know. So he said, 300, is that all right for you? So I got 300 Kiwi dollars to play for 3 hours on my own, me and my Bowron, no microphone, to a whiskey drinking crowd on a Friday. It was like going to the gym. It was horrendous. My first paycheck. Well, Clive got it through his bank account. But anyway, it was my first paycheck, and that's kind of got me the ball rolling. And then I did the gig up in the ATA Centre with this big dance show. And then I went to Australia, and I got a couple of gigs in Australia. And I was on to my father one day, and he says, there's a fellow out there, Owen Verling. I work with his father in West Cork, the Fuchsia brand, which was a leader, a European funded thing. And he says, you should look out for Owen. I said, oh yeah, I'm not going to call up a guy saying my father knows your father. Like, anyway, I got a gig for that St. Patrick's Day 2013, right? It's a turning point in my musical career. And the guy said, you can get the gig. It was a 6-hour gig, right? Break for like sausages. And he said, you can get the gig if you can find the box player. So I phoned up this guy and he says, hi, my dad knows your dad. Would you like to play music on St. Patrick's Day? He said, oh yeah, sure, Grant. So myself and Owen played and we hit it off. And we kept in touch. But when we got back to Ireland, he was going around the world as well. When we got back to Ireland, I got a gig. Ronan Leonard got me a gig in the Lobby Bar. I was playing with this band called the Flying Pigs as well. Myself and Dave Kavanagh were doing kind of ballads, like, you know.
Oh, so was it a duo then?
Yeah, myself and Dave Kavanagh was a duo, but we'd we just sing the top 40 Irish ballads, like, you know, for just cold money, like. And we were funny enough, but then I got a gig in the Lobby Bar, and so Dave said, well, you know what, no, Martin, he said, you'll put in so much practice and the outcome you get from that is so minimal compared to just sitting here and reading from a book. So I said, oh yeah, but I wouldn't mind a nicer gig, like. So I got a friend of mine, Mick Heffernan, and Kevin McNally, and we just did a show. And then we got Owen, and then we were the Fuchsia Band. Do you see there? No, we went from the Fuchsia Brand, which is what our fathers were,
to
the Fuchsia
Band.
And so then my wife moved.
I've heard your album.
That's right, thanks very much, Sean. Yeah, we made a dodgy demo. My wife moved to Kansas City, and we sent out the dodgy demo to her in August of 2004. And she passed it around, and we were getting gigs here and there in Ireland, and a fella in Weston, Missouri took me on, Sean O'Malley. I'll never forget him. $100 to play for an hour and 40 minutes, me and my Bowron, into a whiskey drinking crowd at a festival in a cavern out in Weston, Missouri.
Well, it's probably worth more than Kiwi dollars, so I'd say it's an improvement.
Yeah, it's probably an improvement. Well, might balance out, actually. Because he gave me $140.
Okay.
But I remember I played there, and Dan Regan was watching from the Kansas City Irish Fest, and Eddie De La Hunt had kind of taken me under his wing. But I played the gig, John, and it said in my bio, storyteller. So someone said, "Hey, Paddy, crack me a joke." And everyone's like, "Oh, who said that?" So I told a story, and it went down good. It went down all right. "Ah, yeah, that was funny. Crack another." It's like, So anyway, I got through it. And Dan Regan booked the Fuchsia Band the following year. So the Fuchsia Band came out for a tour, big tour. We got that gig, and then we got a gig down in Jackson, Mississippi, because of Hurricane Katrina came in. Some people flew us down, myself and all people.
Wow.
This Kevin and Martha Kiley gave up their...
Was that a fundraising event?
No, it's a festival, but with Hurricane Katrina, they lost half of their entertainment for the year. They had John Doyle and Liz Carroll as the lead kind of act, and then loads of them were missing. They didn't know when they turn up. And Kevin and Martha Kiley gave up a wedding ring. She was going to finally get a diamond ring after apartheid. She was going to have a diamond without blood in it. And she gave it up so she could fly us down last minute. And we played with Kevin and with Dan Penzine, who I'm playing with here today in Dublin. And we hit it off. It was great. And the following year, we had loads of festivals. And the following year, we had an 11-week tour in 2007. It was massive. And we were taking off, and it was going grand. And then, as things go, bands kind of go and come and go. And we're all making babies now with the Fuchsia Band, you know. But I have a new band here. So, like, the snowball has kept going. I moved to America.
What's the name of your new band here?
The new band here is Galfin. So Hurricane Katrina brought myself and Don together. We've been fast friends ever since.
All right.
And then during the time of Hurricane Sandy, myself, Don, Brian Conway and John Whelan were teaching in Wachacolli in Texas at the O'Flaherty Retreat. And Ken had got us down there to teach. And it's on a Baptist retreat center. So Don opened a speakeasy in his room. And so we'd hang out there. Then Hurricane Sandy came, and Delta had phoned Brian to say that he'd have to get a flight the day before he was supposed to. He was supposed to fly out on Sunday, and said he'd have to get the Saturday flight if you're going to make it home. So they said, "Would you go up on stage with John?" So she said, "Yeah, no problem, but I was going to bring Don with me." And so John said, "That's fine." And then we were sitting down at the table that day, and John said, "Martin, why don't you come up as well for the last bit?" So I said, "Okay, grand." And someone made a YouTube video and put it up on YouTube. And then when Don was looking for a gig for the Martin the Kogan Project out in Savannah, Georgia, they said, "Hey, how about this new band?" And we're like, "What new band?" So yes, certainly we can get the new band. And that's how it started. That's how it started. So we released our album today, or yesterday.
Ah, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks very much. Released it. It's called Won't You Come Out Tonight?
Sure.
So that's the roundabout long story, John, of my musical career.
Well, that's fantastic. That was a lovely story, and thank you for sharing it. I have a couple things to ask you. So you're a singer and a Bowron player. What advice would you have for both disciplines?
Well, I suppose for anything in folk music, your ears are your biggest advantage, you know what I mean? Listening, like, because unlike a lot of things where it's just projection upon people, I find folk music is more of a conversation than anything else. You know what I mean? For songs now,
right?
Like, you know, I couldn't be very sure about other disciplines, but like, you know, in other disciplines you might just sing it every time you might sing it. You know what I mean? And you just do as you learned it and push it through. But with a folk song, you have to kind of connect to the people. You know what I mean? You have to kind of look them in the eye. Sometimes close your eyes. But you have to feel it, and you have to feel the occasion and check yourself and say, hold on now, is this the right song for this moment in time? You know what I mean? To stick hard and fast to your set list sometimes can be a hindrance. So like as a folk singer, in the Irish tradition anyway, I think you've got to know what song suits what audience and be willing to change at the last minute as well, you know? And then for the Bowron player, you know, there's so many jokes about Bowron playing, isn't there? You have to be very careful. Like,
I may have heard a few.
We've such a bad name, like, and you know, there's a lot to be said for the bad name that we have. Like, you know, as a Bowron playing community, like, you know, often people say one Bowron is one too many. You know, so if you see a Bowron playing in a session, and session music, a lot of people join this fraternity of like unsociable, like half autistic people, like who can't even look each other in the eye or shake hands, but they're amazing musicians, you know. Yeah. They don't know how to hold a conversation, but they can play music together like they're a band, you know what I mean? But this, when people get together for a session, that's their conversation for the week. I remember listening to a discussion at Augusta Irish Celtic Week between Dan Neely was questioning Patrick Arceau and Tony DeMarco, two big fiddlers, and Patrick Arceau put it that this, like, when you walk into a bar anywhere, that these people might be having the same conversation for 20 years, and to burst in on that conversation, you know, is quite rude. So you have to kind of go in gently as a ballroom player or as a singer and say, hello, is it okay if I join in? You know what I mean? And to know that there's you know, there's ethics involved and everything, but like there's a session etiquette that you have to be aware of. Like, you know, if there's a ballroom player there already, you'd wait and try and catch his eye or her eye and say, listen, do you want to swap in and out? I'm a ballroom player here or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I play guitar. So yeah, it's the same rules of engagement.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like you... some people would say one guitar player is one too many.
Yeah. You know, depending on where you are, like, I mean, jeepers, they wouldn't have any boron or guitar at all, you know. You'd hear them cursing as before you even open the door.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Or those, like, cautious glances as soon as you walk like, through the door.
Oh, here he is.
There's a round case or a guitar-shaped one.
Yeah, that's it. So, like, for boron players, you know, just to be aware, like, that 10% goes towards your ear and 90% goes to the rest of the room, like, you know. Yeah. And that's the main thing to be aware of as a percussion, as a backer, like, you know.
So, Martin, after the Dublin Irish Festival, what's next for you?
I go home now, wash my clothes, and then we're off to Montana, the Re-Raw Festival in Butte, Montana. We're looking forward to that. That's going to be my first time in Montana. That's next weekend. And then I have a couple of weekends off. And then Galphin are down at Jackson, Mississippi Celtic Fest. You should go there yourself, John. It's pretty good. That's the second weekend, the weekend after Labor Day in Jackson, Mississippi.
I'll see if I can make it. I might be able to.
Yeah. It's a lovely festival. It's very trad. All trad.
Right.
You know? Biggest Kaylee in the South. We have about 400 people dance for 4 hours nonstop. The sweat. They make a lake for the rest of the year with all the sweat.
Broken
toes. And then we're off to the Indy Irish Fest after that. The weekend after that in the Irish Fest in Indianapolis, and then I'm playing in La Vita, Colorado at the end of September for the Spanish Peaks International Music Festival, Celtic Music Festival, and then I have a thing in Las Vegas with Tourism Ireland, and that's it for the year. Then that'll be quite enough after that. There's a couple of things maybe might come into it, but it's quite enough after that and quite a new year, but that's intentional. The next summer now is going to be a big harvest with Galphin.
Yeah. Well, Martin, thank you so much for joining us today on the Celtic Music Lab, and I hope to see you at a festival coming up soon.
Well, thanks very much, John, and thanks for listening out there, everybody. That's my story, and if there's a lie in it, I didn't put it there. And if it's there, well, it can stay there now.
Hey, this is Tom Delaney from Four Winds, and you listen to Celtic Music Lab for the Crackley.
Well, thanks, John, for going to the trouble to get that great interview with Martin. He is quite the character.
Thank you all very much for listening. We'll hope you tune back into Celtic Music Lab. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, and Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tommy Martin here, thanking you very much for taking the time to listen to our Celtic Music Lab podcast. And we hope you take the time to drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook and say hi, and let us know any of your thoughts on any of the subjects that we'll chat about, because we'll come back to them again.
Yeah, and don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Podbean, or wherever you get your podcasts. So once again, thank you all very much for listening.
And take care, everybody. Have a great week.
Tune in next week for another episode of Celtic Music Lab. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, and wherever you get your podcasts. Celtic Music Lab is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.